The easiest way to secure and accelerate your website is with Encapsula, protecting over 4 million sites, from individual bloggers to the Fortune 50. Visit encapsula.com/packetpushers and use promo code DATANAUTS to get a 30-day free trial.
Blogging is such a weird word. I mean, say it out loud. Blog. 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 Originally a shortened form of web log. The blog has gone through a lot of different twists and turns over the years, and in the DataNauts ecosystem, both Ethan and I have found blogging to be a interesting outlet for what mad ravings our minds have come up with. So is it too late to start a blog? Should you be blogging? Why the heck do we blog? Are there benefits to it? There's so many questions, and we've got the answers here on today's episode of the DataNauts podcast. Howdy, I am Chris Wall. You can follow me at Chris Wall, and with me is my co-host who still uses a chalkboard to sketch out his network designs. He's Ethan Banks at EC Banks on the Twitters, and this is, of course, the DataNauts podcast. You can find this and all of our shows on iTunes, in your favorite podcatcher, or at packetpushers.net. So, Ethan, are you ready for some blog navel-gazing this week?
I've been blogging since 2007. I'm sure I've blogged well over a million words and well over 1,000 articles at this point. My navel is deep indeed.
Whoa. That's not exactly where I thought you'd go with the answer to that question, but as long as there's no lint. Okay, so what we're doing with this show, folks, is, like I said, a little bit of navel-gazing, a little bit of discussion around some common questions that we get as longtime bloggers. I haven't been doing it as long as Ethan has. I started in 2010, but I guess 6 or so years is long enough to have an opinion, and Ethan's been doing it since before the word blog existed, I suppose. Did that exist back then?
Yes, come on, man. I'm not that old. Jeez.
All right, so the first question that, yeah, I love Ribbon the Man. The first question that comes up, and it's typically the most common, is how do you come up with content? Ethan, what's your process to come up with what the heck are you going to write about?
So content for me is always about experience. What have I been working on? So now my job has transitioned a little bit where for the last couple of years, I've been running a media company primarily. So let me back up a step and go prior to that. It was, what am I working on? So I had a project at a company I was working at where I was installing new Cisco Nexus switches. And I was using virtual port channel technology. And so I wrote about that. I had a great detail of things I was doing for that project that were important and no lack of things to blog about relating to that. Lately, it's been things that I've been hearing about in presentations. Someone will give a discussion or a talk at a conference, and something they say will either catch me the right way or maybe the wrong way, and it will inspire me to blog. Sometimes things just piss me right the heck off, and I got to get it off my chest. Sometimes trying to pop the Silicon Valley bubble a little bit, actually I'm sitting in the middle of it in a hotel right now. And you just got to there's a real world perspective that needs to be shared here that I don't think a vendor or an open source project or whoever is getting right. And I'm inspired to write about it. And I seem to have no lack of ideas. I mean, it's very rare that I don't have something either that I've been working on or maybe a certification I'm studying for or something I've heard other people talking about that doesn't launch an idea where there's something I want to blog about. What about you?
It comes and goes. I tend to have spurts of time in my brain where I have a lot of ideas. And traditionally, it's been my role as a customer in enterprise IT, as well as a consultant in enterprise IT. And I will say, when I was consulting for large enterprise, large commercial accounts, the blog spigot was just spewing ideas because every day it was like, here's our 37 problems. How would you solve them? It's like, oh, well, I know about 34 of them, but the other three I've never seen before. I also had access to a lot of lab gear from vendors and my employer. And it was really fun to dig into them and realistically find bugs and issues and things like that to help others avoid what I call the landmines within technology, where it's like, hey, if you press these keys together, which are in the user guide, you're going to explode your environment. So here's how not to explode your environment, as well as my passion around storage protocols, which kind of sounds weird to say that out loud, but I've always been if you've heard the Andy Banta episode, we talk about iSCSI, which I felt was like the devil of the internet. Or at least storage protocols. I was always into NFS.
Not Andy, just to be clear, but iSCSI.
Yeah. No, Andy's a good guy. He's not the devil of the internet. He definitely has the coolest t-shirts out there. But realistically, just things that I was encountering. And I had a bump to the place that I was working a very open-minded employer that was really cool with me talking about stuff, but not, I'm working with this particular customer and here's the password to their routers, because we know it's always admin anyways. So I didn't really need to write about that. So long story short, it was really just what I was doing day to day and things that interest me as a technologist, engineer, whatever. And that comes to another point that comes up, or another question that comes up quite a bit is, what if someone else has written about a topic that you want to cover? I mean, what's your opinion on that, Ethan?
Write about it anyway. Oh, someone else already wrote about it. So if I write something, then it won't be original, or it won't be. Yeah, whatever. Just, you know, your perspective, your take, your personal experience is unique to you. And as long as you take the time to put your personal stamp on whatever that topic is, you'll bring something to the table that maybe someone else didn't. And that's fine. Even if someone else did write about it, you know, when you were like, you thought their post was very good, fine. You write about it too, and then you link to their post at the bottom, you know, more reading or, and hey, I found this other article on this topic too. That's good. That's good for everybody. That's good for, you know, SEO, search engine optimization, where it makes your traffic or your articles and their articles more likely to come up in Google search results, and that's better for the community at large. No, I have no problem at all with someone having written something. That doesn't stop me from writing it. It's just, you know, more content about that topic is a good thing. So more the merrier, and you'll put a spin on it that's unique to you.
Yeah, absolutely. So that one comes up a lot, and I feel the same way. It really doesn't matter if someone else has written about it, because the answer is yes, someone has written about it. It's pretty much all, like, it's the internet. There's 6 to 7 billion people floating around out there with opinions. And so, yeah, you're going to have duplicate content out there from a high idea perspective. It's okay to write about it, but here's what I advise. If you find another piece of content, especially if you found that it was helpful or you liked the way the author arranged it, or just something where you're like, hey, I'd like to give this person the nod, there is a thing called a pingback. And that's where you write a post of some sort and you include a link to that person's article. Most all platforms for blogging today is going to ping the author of the article that you're linking. And it actually creates a comment on their blog saying, I wrote about your stuff. Yay, I like it. It's good. And the internet is really kind of built on linking to one another. So it's not like you're giving them traffic and it's a bad thing. You're giving them traffic and it helps with your ranking on Google search. You know, if you're linking to good people and good people are linking to you, it's like that whole the high tide raises all boats kind of idea. So you definitely want to do that.
That's especially critical for independent content, that Google is aware that that content exists, because I'll tell you, the vendors who write content, some of that content is good. Some of it's just marketing drivel that they spew out the funnel because they have people they have hired to do that. And so they're constantly throwing new content out on their vendor blogs. And because of the volume and the fact that those people know how to work the system with keywords and their size, and they know how to stay in touch with Google and drive their content up through the rankings. So those of us that are independent bloggers, where a lot of times that viewpoint is sought out, it can get drowned out by the noisy vendor SEO optimized blogs. And so linking to each other is a really key way to help Google go, oh, wait, this is good stuff, and I should drive it up through the rankings and try to get it on that page one of the search results, which is a really big deal.
In my early days, I had a rule where I would try to find 1 to 3 articles that I thought were good and were people that maybe I enjoyed reading on my content, and make sure to include them. Like towards the bottom of the post, I would say, here's some other great ways you can look at this content or look at this idea and read it. Because I feel like that helps grow the awareness of the community around what you're creating, and the pingbacks are always a good thing. Switching gears a little bit, content comes and goes. You know, like some days you know, I talked about having more ideas than others. And I think it's good to have a tool in mind to help you jot down these ideas. So I'll just share mine real quick. And I'm super low tech, right? So I use WordPress as my blog platform. And it gives me the ability to make a draft post without having to actually click a lot of buttons. There's literally like a create draft link on the front page of my dashboard. And so when I have an idea, I'll just literally write down like a short sentence saying, make blog post about the new release of UCS firmware or something. And then I could put some links and images and just some thoughts. I'll probably have 6 to 12 drafts sitting in the WordPress platform, letting me know these are things that I just wanted to save, because if I don't remember them or if I don't jot them down, I won't remember them. That's just not going to happen. I'm way too scatterbrained for that to be saved in my noodle. What about you? What do you use to save your ideas?
I do most of my writing in a tool called Scrivener. If you Google Scrivener, it's a software that's available for Mac and for Windows, as well as iOS, so that you can sync all of your files together. Scrivener is aimed at people who are authors writing books. Now, I'm not typically writing books. I'm usually doing one article at a time. But Scrivener is still the system that I'm engaged with. And for me, I moved into that. If I had one outlet, like one blog, Chris, where I was writing, then yes, exactly what you're saying would be just the thing. Because there's a WordPress app you can use on your phone, which would just be great to slam an idea down so you don't lose it when you've got it, which I think is the big deal here. You're sitting somewhere and you're like, oh my gosh, this is like, I mean, I'll be sitting in, I don't know, church or something where you can't, you don't have the freedom to up and, you know, go do whatever, but I can sit there on my phone. It's like, boom, I can slam in an article and the main points of the article because all of a sudden it just like explodes in your head. You don't want to lose that. So back to Scrivener. Scrivener is, because I'm writing for a lot of different outlets, I'm writing for my own blog, I'm writing for packetpushers.net, my company. Occasionally I'll write for other outlets like TechTarget or Network Computing, something like that. All of the ideas, and depending on where they're aimed, I have folders built out for them within Scrivener that allow me to, here's an idea that might work for my newsletter, here's an idea that might work for packetpushers.net, etc. And then no matter where I am, on my phone, in front of my laptop, on the road, in front of my iMac at home, I just slam that idea in there. It has an idea called a synopsis where I can write a kind of a working article title and then the bullet points of what that article is going to be and then save it. And then when I'm like, wow, I didn't have time to write, but I have time to write now. What have I got? I go into Scrivener. I look in my folders and my ideas folders and it's like, yes, I remember what that was all about. And then I can sit there and write. So Chris, which I guess is a kind of an interesting comment that I do save these ideas because I don't always have time to write, but then I do have time to write and I'll sit. And for me, it's just, all right, I've carved out this, you know, hour or two. I'm going to sit and write this post, you know, 500 to 1,000 words and get it done. And as long as I sit during that time and focus on it, I can get it done. But that's always tricky because life is distracting. I mean, do you have a technique or a system that you use so that when it's time to write, you can actually get the article done and hit publish?
I do. And I've actually written about it a few different times because I'm really a big fan of it. I've got some pretty significant OCD. So the Pomodoro technique is what I use, and it really feeds into my mental state. And realistically, it's just the idea of it's some common sense stuff. Number one, you eliminate all distractions. So turn off basically everything. Some are easier than others. Some easy ones are like, you know, set your phone to mute and close tabs for email and Twitter and Facebook and stuff like that. Others I feel are harder based on your living situation. You know, if you're trying to blog at work, you can't just turn off work, or maybe you shouldn't be blogging at work. I don't know. It depends on what you're being paid for. But let's say you're at home, which is probably a much more common use case for writing blogs. If you've got kids running around, that's important. That's a priority. You know, your family.
Oh, I thought you were going to say to shut them off. No?
Yeah. Okay. To execute. No. Just, I don't know. I don't know. You know the secrets of kids more than I do. But, you know, I've just heard these are challenges. And so my advice would be, regardless of what your living situation is, have a conversation. Let them know, hey, this is what I'm doing. This is why. I feel like there's a lot of business and career value to blogging that you can express. And just state that you need 30 minutes or 60 minutes or whatever it is to lock yourself in a room, eliminate all distractions. Because what you're going to do is chunk up your time into 25-minute segments. You're going to focus on the task at hand, which is writing a blog post for 25 minutes. And regardless of your progress within the blog post, at the end of 25 minutes, you're going to stop. You're going to put down all the work and you're going to spend 5 to 10 minutes not doing anything related to that task. You know, go play with the kids, go eat a sandwich or, you know, watch a little bit of TV, whatever it is. And then return to the task at hand for another 25 minutes, just like you would take rests between doing a bunch of push-ups or sit-ups or running or something like that. You're resting the brain. And if you rotate between 25 minutes of task and then 5 minutes or 10 minutes of break, what you'll find, at least what I find, is that I'm 2 to 3 times more effective at completing the task.
Yeah, I don't.
Ethan doesn't agree.
Well, I don't subscribe to Pomodoro specifically. So I'm aware of it. I've read about it, but I've never broken anything up quite that.
Don't you live in like the mountains? You don't have distractions anyways. And it's like a bird flies by.
I have lots of distractions. Squirrels, actually, more than birds. But, you know, for me, as long as I shut off the distractions, I am able to sit and focus on something for as long as maybe a couple hours at a time. I used to be better at it, but over time, distractions seem to come unbidden now when maybe before social media and stuff, they didn't so much. But I am able to sit and just bang it out without having to break stuff up. Now, I definitely got to say that I need breaks. I need to get up and walk away, do something, and come back. And for me, that might be, like, I work from home and I have an office. Well, I'll leave the office and I'll go into the kitchen and drink a coffee or something. But that's not on a rigorous, like, 25 and 5, you know, minute schedule, which I think Pomodoro is pretty regimented like that if you follow it closely, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's what I like about it. I like the rigidity of the system, because otherwise, I know we both kind of have our squirrel moments, like, oh, squirrel, something else comes up. The fact that I am just laser focused on one thing, it really supports the science behind the fact that the human brain cannot multitask. We context switch, which is basically floating between multiple different tasks.
Yes.
In like a unitask type of process. There's no parallelism to the brain. And so if I'm able to really dedicate 100% of what's available in my noodle to a task, I will complete it quicker. And having that rigid structure around it is what enables me to do it. Because otherwise, I follow this thread, and 20 minutes later, I'm like, why am I watching my third cat video? You know, it's like, what happened?
It's the same for me, whether it's blogging or some other thing. No matter what the task is, I have to be laser, as you put it, laser focused on that task to get it done. On the days where I remain laser focused, then I get a lot done. And on the days when I allow myself to be distracted, I'm screwed. I get little bits of a lot of things kind of sort of accomplished, but nothing really completed. So it's the focus that, and for a blog article, I mean, that's key. You're telling a story when you blog. So you it's got an intro and then a middle and then a conclusion. And you want to keep your brain focused throughout, or else you disappear. And if you come back 3 days later because you got distracted and never did get the stupid thing written, you're like, what was I thinking? You've lost your train of thought. You've lost the punch that piece had you stayed focused on it.
Absolutely. So let's cover one more concern, and that's, hey, I work somewhere, and that's where all the cool stuff is happening, but I don't want to give away trade secrets. I don't want to get in trouble. I don't want to get fired, right? Nobody wants to get canned for
it. Let me tell you what I'm doing at a financial institution that's really important and very secretive about their operational practices.
Here's my SSH keys. Don't worry about it. So you're working somewhere and you want to share content around that. And I've always been working somewhere. It's like, you know, we're all doing work at somewhere, something, whether it's consulting and you're working with clients or you're working a day job where you're the customer. At a high level, I think you're always within your rights to share ideas and thoughts and your opinions on things, as long as those are original. Like, don't just copy somebody. But I'd start to get really careful when it comes to your employment contract. Does your employer retain intellectual rights on what you do? That would control whether or not you can just share raw bits of code that are sanitized or unsanitized. Always sanitize your code and your configs. I would say this is the credo that I lived by as a consultant, was that I never share anything, not one thing, about my clients. Not even as like, oh, they're the best provider of widgets in the South. Like, someone knows what that means. You're going to get in trouble. That's not cool. There's an implicit trust between you and who you're working with. So there's the ability to have written permission to write about someone. Even then, I think that's risky. I would just generalize the client, because it doesn't really matter who it is you're working for. Just abstract the problem away from the details. You know, like, oh, we had a problem. We wanted to deploy 2,000 Horizon View desktops for something. Doesn't really matter too much. Explain your understanding of the technology and how you are part of the solution and why that works. And I think you can get away with that to the point where it's not going to give away any special information.
Yeah, I took that one step further, which is on my LinkedIn profile, I didn't even have any of my former employers listed. I just had a kind of a generic, I've been a network engineer for 20 years working at a whole bunch of companies doing these sorts of things, because I wasn't doing consulting too often, maybe on the side a little bit, but that wasn't my primary role. I would leave that off just to avoid anyone looking at something I'd written, looking up my LinkedIn profile, and then trying to make a correlation and go, ah, okay, so their core network looks like something based on something I'd written. Now that I am not tied to any one specific company at this point, I actually went back into my LinkedIn in the last few months and put in a lot of those old jobs, network engineer positions and so on, that I've held over the last 20 years, back in there, because now it's all history. It doesn't really matter, and so on. I completely agree. You don't want to, you know, for two reasons. You don't want to make yourself a target of opportunity for some security hacker type that wants to come after your infrastructure by inferring what your world is like based on what you've written and where you work. That's one thing. And then another thing is legal liability. You don't want your employer either to be exposed to some sort of legal liability because of something you've written, or you to be exposed to some sort of legal liability because of something you've written about your company where they actually decide to get really ugly with you, which all of those things are unlikely to happen, but possible. And to what end? What is it? Purpose does it serve to talk about the employer or to talk about the site where you're doing this kind of work? Leave that off. It doesn't add anything to the, if you're a technical blogger, you're not really adding anything to the mix by disclosing where this is all happening. It's generally, I think it's a bad idea.
DataNauts listeners, Ethan here. I'm sure you're aware that DDoS attacks are a normal part of life. You've probably been hit by one, or you're going to be at some point in the future, and our sponsor Encapsula can protect you from those DDoS attacks, distributed denial of service, while also offering bot protection, website security, load balancing, a content distribution network, and it is all one easy-to-use service. And if you're missing what the point of this is, the big idea is to put Encapsula in front of your website so that your website is protected. Your website will continue to deliver content even when bad things are happening. The thing here is that Encapsula is seeing all of your traffic anyway, so they're going to block that bad stuff, which is maybe the most important thing. But since they're seeing it all, they're going to accelerate that good stuff too. The bad stuff goes away, the good stuff gets even better. And if you think DDoS protection is no big deal, I personally think it's a really big deal. It's not hard these days for someone to build or even rent someone's command and control network and then unleash terror on your website, keeping your web down, offline. Encapsula protects you from this sort of an attack because they have their own massive network, 3 terabit per second network with 30 data centers housing their packet scrubbers. And I love this little detail. They codenamed their packet scrubbers Behemoth. Behemoth scrubbers can handle 500 million packets per second, and all of that put together means that putting Encapsula in front of your website means that you can withstand a DDoS attack. So to add Encapsula's capabilities to your website, visit encapsula.com/packetpushers and use promo code DataNauts to get a 30-day free trial. One more time, that's encapsula.com/packetpushers. And use promo code DataNauts to get a 30-day free trial.
Chris, we were talking about inspiration before and how you find inspiration. And for a lot of us, it's, you know, we're employed somewhere, we're doing a consulting job, and we've got this hardware we're working on to get it installed or something. And so we've got this hands-on experience with stuff. But that's, you know, not practical a lot of times. I mean, and lately, you know, the last few years or so, I've had a home lab. I've got a couple of VMware machines. Sometimes I'll get switches that are shipped to me to work on by some vendor that is hopeful I'll write nice things. And so I don't have a lot of money tied up in home lab, but it's certainly given me a lot of flexibility. But I got to say, I haven't done too much with the actual hardware. Most of it has gone from hardware recently to software. It's noisy, requires a lot of electricity. So as much as I can possibly do in software to experiment with things is kind of the route I've gone. Now, I've seen pictures of your lab, at least what you used to have. I don't know what you have anymore, but man, I remember pictures of racks with lots of different servers and NUCs and you know, maybe some storage hardware and various things. Do you still have a big complicated setup like that?
I do. You know, a little bit of it is I think having a home lab is a lot of fun. You know, I kind of invested more money than I probably should. But man, it's a lot of fun to build out an environment, especially when I dealt with, if you're consulting with folks, you're typically there because you're trying to solve a problem and you deal with all these really ugly environments, and to have this pristine, perfect, I'm the only person in it, just ideal environment that is exactly the way you want it is kind of fun. And I like buying the right color and length cables and labeling them and making everything pretty. So certainly, yeah, but there's also the learning aspect to it.
But there's one little kind of side point here is you mentioned money. I mean, you've invested in a home lab, but that's a personal investment that you feel was worthwhile.
Sure, sure. It was a conversation. My first investment was buy a server from Dell, like the T110. I think it was about $1,000. And that was a tough conversation. Like, oh, I'm going to blow $1,000 on a piece of equipment for the house. You know, like, why do you buy a server for the house? That was kind of weird at the time. To not do anything, really, except to build up stuff and blow it up. because I was going for my VMware Certified Professional certification. So I was like, hey, if I get this, I can get my BCP, I can buy some Cisco gear, I can get my CCNA, which is the network associate level Cisco exam. So it fed into some other things. And I felt like as an infrastructure engineer, as an operations engineer, there's so many layer one problems that are masked by pristine environments that someone sets up for you that I had overcome. Like just designing, all right, how do I want within my budget to design layer one and layer two? That's not necessarily easy, and I want to use different vendors to do that. And I don't know, I felt like there was enough learning that is just abstracted nowadays with virtual environments to make it worth blowing some money on. Now, you know, do you need to spend five figures on it? Like I have, probably not. In fact, certainly not. That's, now I'm just getting goofy with it. But there was a lot of things that I learned out of it. I'm very happy that I did.
Well, I think to your point, if you are a blogger, a technical blogger, and you have a relationship with a vendor, very often they will be delighted
True.
To work with you on things like software keys, getting something. They're not going to give you like, here's an enterprise level key that you can do all the things. Not typically. They're going to give, but they'll help you to make it easy for you in your home lab to run their software so that you can blog about it if that's something that you're interested in doing, because who doesn't love free exposure?
Well, and even hardware too. Like I used a lot of Synology gear and it was never free, but they certainly gave me some discount codes and early access to some beta software. And in fact, this company named IOSafe did drop a unit off that was like a long-term eval that they've just said, we don't really want it back because it weighs 100 pounds because it's literally a fireproof safe with a Synology inside of it. So you pick up little pieces along the way for friends, you know, like, hey, I want a 10 gig switch. Oh, I've got this old Brocade 8K. Here, you can just have this. So it's not like you have to buy everything pristine and new, but it's certainly not the only way to get free stuff. There's definitely software. I mean, software is king. So there's the VMware Hands-On Lab if you just don't want to have a lab at all. But there's more likely the idea of doing MSDN to get the server essentials license. I forget what it's called. They have a
MSDN, license. I thought they killed that.
They do. So they got rid of TechNet, which was awesome. It was like $100 a year for every piece of software ever made. Now it's all been rolled up in MSDN, and they have like a servers or a platforms license that's just Windows and Exchange and, you know, all the business apps and all the operating systems. Unfortunately, as an MVP from Microsoft, their most valuable professional evangelist program, I get MSDN like Superman level for free. But prior to that, I was actually purchasing the low-level MSDN to get all my free or my learning license keys for Microsoft technologies.
But increasingly, there are more and more online labs that can give you great fuel for blog posts. So you mentioned VMware's Hands-On Labs. So a networking company that comes to mind is Big Switch Networks. They're a startup in the SDN space. Well, they've been around for about 5 years now. I don't know if you can still call them a startup, but they have a online lab program where you can spin up a software-defined network using Big Switch's software and work it all online. And there's a lot of virtual machines now for switching and routing that you can assemble in using a software platform like GNS3. So you can do a ton of stuff with software these days.
I think the takeaway there is twofold. One, it doesn't really matter if you're going to go hardware or cloud, we'll say, like, you know, non-hardware lab, virtual lab, cloud lab, because ultimately both forks in the road are going to require you to learn something that you probably don't know. Like if you're going to go physical lab, you've got to work within the constraint of probably a very low budget. How are you going to put it all together? Heat, cooling? Are you going to buy, like me, just a baker's rack for a kitchen to put everything in there? If you're going in a cloud environment, then you have to learn at a very basic level, how does AWS put their stuff together, or GCE for the Google Compute side or whatever. So you're going to gain some valuable insights there, and you can blog about that, right? And then you can go into the software stack that you want to learn, unless you're using something that's kind of like software as a service. Maybe you're looking to code for ServiceNow or use Pivotal or something, and you just want to, or a Droplet from DigitalOcean, you just want to learn how to do Terraform and things like that.
I think the bigger key is once you've got your lab established, whatever that is, and there's a ton of options now, and a lot of them are cheaper than you'd think. You just got to ask the right person to help you out and get you pushed in the right direction. What's the story you're going to tell now in your blog? What is the angle on this information that you're gleaning? What are you trying to accomplish? Are you sharing how to configure a specific feature? Are you proving out a vendor claim? You know, we can do X. Okay, well, I'm going to go do X, you know, and then see how that works. What is the thing that you're going to do with that information now that you're going to share with the world? That, and that's something that you want to be thinking about. It's not just that you're in the lab and screwing around and it was fun. It was, now it's, how do you take a piece of information, this concept that you learned and got a hold of, and then share it with someone else in a way that they can then consume? I know some people blog just because it's like, oh, it's my own notes so that I remember how I did something. Well, think about it for a broader audience. What if you were trying to teach someone else? You know, what are the things that they need to know and understand to be able to utilize this information? And you can't boil the ocean in every blog post, but you can be thinking about, okay, this could be a new concept to them. Let me share a few introductory paragraphs that explain the concept, and then, you know, in the middle, I'm going to do a, you know, a demo of how this worked, and then some concluding thoughts about how applicable it is to the real world. Something like that, that, you know, you build a story from beginning to end, and all of the things you're doing in the lab are the, you know, the fuel that drive the content of that blog post.
That's a good point, and you got me thinking, in that pretty much every blog post I write, I don't really know what it's going to be until it's done. It's not like I do all the work and then I start the post knowing full start to finish what it's going to be.
It's going to be SpongeBob.
Yeah, well, of course. He's yellow and porous. So here's some tips that I tend to use. One, if you're digging into something, before you even have a blog post created or whatnot, go ahead and take notes, take screenshots. One thing that I'll do for something that's brand new and I have no idea what the heck is going to happen, it's going to explode everywhere or who knows, I'll just start recording my monitor using Camtasia. Just so that I have footage so that I can go back and say, okay, I need an image of installing the database for this one thing and I need this particular widget. Okay, just roll back to that point, grab an image, and then I have a screenshot to throw into the blog post. Because when it's something brand new, I don't necessarily know what's interesting or what's not. Maybe I'll find that it was just like next finish and that was kind of boring. Okay, I don't need that. And also, I think this is important. Here's the key takeaway for that. If you're new with a technology, you're looking at it through the lens of a new person. So everything is kind of like interesting and everything's kind of an oddity. You're going to see something that's not normal, that's a quirk or an oddity of the stack versus folks that are in the trenches. They know that the third option's always going to be X, right? So you may be like, why is it X? That doesn't make sense. Every other piece of software I've worked for was Z instead. So you only get to be new at something once. Having notes or recording or something to allow you to poke at that is going to give you really critical pieces of information to share in a blog post.
So, Chris, you said sometimes you write a blog post, you don't actually know what it's going to be because you don't know, you know, until you actually work with this thing and see what it does and you're doing the screen grabs and so on. And then you find inspiration in there and create a blog post. So, okay, now you've got this idea because of this thing that you've been working on. How do you, well, the way I put it was telling a story. How do you tell the story?
I try to ask a bunch of the, you know, the who, what, where, when, why type questions or really how. I think why and how are complementary. Let's say I'm working through a piece of technology. I'll record all the, like, this is how I did it stuff. But people are really interested, I think, more so in why did I look at it and things like that. So questions that I think are good to answer is, how did you find out about this technology or solution? You know, where did the interest come from? How did you approach gathering the information? Or did you look at documentation? Did you talk to people? How did you set up your environment, you know, the platform or the cloud or the physical lab to support what you're looking to, you know, use? What did you find that was missing, you know, within the environment, your config, the approach, the information, the documents? What was missing? Did that cause issues? How did you configure the entire solution to get to the end of the post? You know, what was your particular configuration? Why did you set it up that way? What did the lab look like? And then finally, did it all work? In some cases, I've set up a blog post. I'm like, wow, this didn't work at all. Why did it not work? Well, because I was missing these components. And what you'll find, I think, is that there's a number of folks that are going through the same kind of journey, and they're going to tend to, you know, do a Google search like, hey, this thing blew up in my face. And you're going to say, yeah, because you set it up this way. Maybe the next post is, I got it right. The first post, maybe I got it wrong, and here's why, and here's what I did to get it working. So I think people are very interested in failure, not in the sense of like, ha ha, point at you, but why do things fail? Because that's how we learn. You know, we triage and we have postmortems based on failure so that we can not repeat that again. So if you can kind of, you know, that there's a Simpsons where it's like there's the skeleton and his bones and his finger are pointing to like the correct path. And it's like, be the skeleton pointing to like, don't go this way, go this other way. There's a lot of value in that. Now, Ethan, what about you? What's your process to kind of dig into the post and get it all laid out?
Outline. I always have an outline when I start to write, but before I start to write, I have to, I've got a topic, I've got a big idea that I want to get across, and then I have an outline that walks me through the process of how I'm going to get there. So now, I'm not always blogging about a specific how-to. These days it's rare that I'm actually blogging about, go to the CLI and you're going to type this command and these magical things will come forth and look, here are all the keywords that you will see. I don't blog about that kind of stuff a lot. These days, I very often blog about higher level concepts and what is software defined WAN really, and going in at it that way. And so it's the outline that I have to have so that I can write. I can't just sit and start writing. It has to be title or, you know, big idea that I want to get across, and then the 3, 4, 5, 8 points that I want to make. And then I go through all of those points and tell the story. And then I end up, you know, at the end that gets me through. And then there's an editing process from there. I don't know how you edit, Chris, but for me, I'm a very heavy self-editor where once I've written the piece, I'm usually quite wordy. I'm not as concise and tight as I should be with my writing. And so I have to go through and clean up the redundancies and the badly phrased sentences. It's like, wow, I couldn't have phrased that any more awkwardly. How can I tighten that up? You know, and make it better, and then reading the whole thing back through so that I know this flows well, this makes sense from beginning to end, it sounds good in my mind, so that someone else reading this, it should feel natural and engaging to them, not awkward or stilted or confusing, or I don't contradict myself within the post, these sorts of things. And again, to make that happen most successfully on the first try, it's all about that outline. It's, again, that idea with the supporting points underneath. And that's the thing that I've got to have before I can write and get that blog post down.
It's interesting hearing you describe that, because I work like the complete opposite way. I don't outline anything. I kind of squirrel in my post. I'll actually write the word intro, and then I'll just hit enter a few times and go right into the meat and start throwing in things that I'm encountering, ideas, thoughts, and it's just kind of like spaghetti. And then I'll go through and reorder it a little bit, because I may not know necessarily the right order in the beginning. I just have a lot of information and things that I'm looking at. And as I complete the process and finish the thought or the idea or the solution, then it starts to formulate in my mind and the outline kind of materializes from the content. One thing I do fully agree with that you talked about is that having a process is important. And I don't think there's ever a way to get it right the very first pass through. Like, you're reading through it again and again and editing a lot. So I think there's a misconception that if you're really good at blogging, you're just going to sit down, you're going to start at the top, you're going to finish at the bottom, you're going to hit publish, and you're done. And I can count on zero fingers how many times that's happened.
Exactly.
Because it doesn't.
No.
So you're going to edit. You want to edit anyways, because things can sound good in your head that just sound like crap when you actually read them through or aloud or just read them through the document. What I tend to do is I'll actually show like a preview of the post, because sometimes even in the editor, it'll look better than when you actually see what it's going to look like when it publishes. And so I'll read it through that way, usually 5 or 6 times before I'm really happy and I'm willing to schedule the post. So I would say editing is not an option. Getting it right the first time is impossible, no matter how long you've done it. In fact, I think really good writers just on purpose rewrite the intro like 2 or 3 times. You know, it's just like, all right, write an intro and then rewrite it and then rewrite it again. I think that's just journalism 101. So just expect that doing editing is normal. You're not a weird, you know, 7-armed octopus or anything. It's just that's the way it's going to be. Hey there! Each week, we put together a show focused on the amazing world of enterprise data centers and their constant challenges to tens of thousands of snazzy listeners. But hey, we're just scratching the surface! So vendors, send an email to sponsors@packetpushers.net for information on how you can build a quality, informative, and fun sponsored show with us, the Datadots podcast crew. We will create impactful content that doesn't suck! Woo! Again, that's sponsors@packetpushers.net. So we've talked a bit about the process, how we create content, how we think of content, and hopefully there's some tips and tricks you can use there if you're already blogging. But if you're not already blogging, you might be wondering, how do I start? I think it's first important to remember that the goal is to generate content that can be shared and ultimately indexed by search engines so people can find it. It's not to win some kind of award, or hopefully you're not looking at, I want 1 million page views, because I've not, you know, I don't get that. So it's just not going to happen. Have realistic goals. You want to make content, share your ideas, and you want other people to find those ideas. Otherwise, you know, you're just writing and no one's gonna see all the beautiful things that you're creating. So I'll just recommend finding a platform that allows you to get going without muxing around. You know, WordPress is pretty popular. It's been around forever. You can just build a free account on WordPress.com. There's another one that's been rather popular that feels a little bit more like I have to learn other things before I can start using my platform, which I'm not a fan of. That's GitHub Pages with like Jekyll or something. I think GitHub Pages alone are pretty simple. But the takeaway here is don't pick a platform that requires you to become a master of it just to use it, because you don't want that to get in the way. You're looking to share information, not become, you know, a CSS ninja overnight.
Yeah, and don't host it yourself, even if it's like, oh, I'm a Linux nerd and I know how to host things and I can stand up a WordPress instance of my own. Yeah, fine. You can totally do that. And if you really want, that's great. But I mean, you're in the blogging business here in the context of what this podcast is about. You're not in the hosting business. Why burden yourself with keeping a server up and running and making sure there's enough bandwidth going to the thing and what your IP address and your domain names are and all of that stuff? Hand that stuff off to someone else and let them, there's no magic in that. Let someone else do that for you so that you can focus on blogging, and that the hosting of it, even though you're a nerd that could do it, it's not about your ability. Sure, you could do it. Anybody can do it if you spend enough time to figure out how. It's just annoying to have to deal with that stuff. Let your hosting provider do all that for you. That's why we're, like you said, WordPress.com, Chris. Yeah, exactly. Just go up there and let them deal with all of that headache for you, rather than you yourself taking on the burden of managing a server platform. And again, the blogging business is what you're here in here, not the hosting business.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's something you can start with. Like, I started on .com and then I moved to a hosted service elsewhere that was all performance optimized. And I think, Ethan, you were the one that even told me who you were using. And I was like, cool, I'll go over there. And that costs some money per month, but I was fine with that. So
there's a bunch of providers out here that are customized for WordPress. So they'll set up a WordPress instance for you. 1&1 comes to mind. There's GoDaddy is out there with a customized WordPress. Bluehost is available. The Packet Pushers folks, we run on a company called Web Synthesis for some of our sites, many of our sites. And so there's definitely options out there if you're looking for WordPress optimized hosting, where they've got the fast cache engines built in and so on. They'll give you great performance, especially if you're just starting out and your blog's not seeing that much traffic anyway. Really, about anyone will get the job done well for you at a very reasonable price.
Yeah, that makes sense. So just pick either GitHub Pages if you just want to be kind of cool and hipster, or make an account on WordPress.com. They're all movable later. There's a ton of projects that makes that simple and easy. I ended up just paying the $99 to move my platform onto Web Synthesis because I'm lazy. You know, I'm in IT. That's like a hallmark of sysadminship. Plus, go ahead and buy a domain name. You know, it's nothing worse than being bob.typepad.com or whatever. It's like $10 a year. And it gives you, in my opinion, enough skin in the game that you feel like, all right, I've made a commitment. I've actually spent real money on this. Again, it's $10. It's like two coffees. And I use actually a strategy where I separate who's hosting my blog from who's registering the domain name. So I use 1&1 to register the domain. I've actually been a customer of theirs for over 10 years. And it just every year they're like, we're going to charge you $14. And I go, cool, that's fine. And it means that my web host and my registrar don't have kind of the combined power over me. If I need to move one, I just have to move the one and repoint, you know, the server or the DNS records, depending. So that's my strategy. I don't know if you subscribe to the same thought, Ethan.
Yeah, I do. I use a service called Hover, hover.com, to buy domain names, and they're my registrar for just about everything. I've got a bunch of domain names that I've collected, or the Packet Pushers as a company has collected over the years. They're parked there, and we point them to hosting wherever else needs to go. It's just nice to have some flexibility where, as you pointed out, the your domain and managing your domain names is one thing. Where your website lives is a different thing, and you don't need those two to be the same thing. Like it can be more convenient that way, but I like to keep them separate. That's nice. You know, GoDaddy would want you to have them all be the same thing, but you don't have to do it that way. And then I'll just throw in Cloudflare and mention them as a service that you may wish to have sitting in front of your blog. And that can help with performance. It can help with protection from DDoS attacks and these sorts of things. And there are free levels of Cloudflare service. And you can read on Cloudflare's site how to get it all set up. But you know, the long and the short of it is your site, your domain name points to some Cloudflare IP address. And then on the back end, you will have configured Cloudflare to pull your content from your actual site. So that routes all your traffic through Cloudflare's servers. That's a good thing. It can protect you and can be helpful. And there's free levels. And if you want to pay, there's advanced levels of caching and protection that Cloudflare will give you as well.
I don't think that's even optional. I think Cloudflare is a must-have just because having a CDN that seeds your content out there is awesome. They give you IPv6 support out the box. And it's just I
and
use the
SSL,
free
yep.
Yeah, SSL to support all of it.
I would go so far as to say it's you absolutely have to have it. But if you're a small site, I mean, man, why wouldn't you? When you get into larger hosting packages, sometimes Cloudflare can actually get in the way where the big hosting provider is doing kind of the same thing Cloudflare is. And so does it make sense or not? And you got to kind of weigh that in the balance. But if you're a small site with a WordPress instance, yeah, I'm kind of in the same camp, Chris. Why wouldn't you leverage Cloudflare?
And plus they blacklist a bunch of places that are trying to attack you and they can help protect your login thing. So yeah, it's something I use for and continue to use a long time as a small little WordPress guy. The last tip I would say that we're going to close out with is go ahead and do what may sound dirty to a lot of you, but I think is a requirement. Create accounts on all the popular social media platforms. You know, Twitter and LinkedIn are two of my favorites. Facebook, I feel, is a little more personal and less businessy. You know, maybe make a Facebook page. Like I have a page for my blog and I have an account for myself on Facebook, so they're separate. Try to keep those accounts consistently named because that's going to be ways that you can share your content. There's also something you can put onto WordPress. It's a plugin called Social Networks Auto Poster or Snap. And what it can do is as you publish content, it can actually push links to that content to all of those various platforms, you know, Google Plus and Twitter and Facebook and whatnot. So it just gives you a way that it's not so much at, oh, I'm going to do this, I'm going to get a bajillion page views, but everyone wants to consume and follow content in a different way. So it allows you to give the people that want to consume your content the choice of how they're going to understand when there's new content. Some people sign up for email, some do RSS, other people just want it on their Facebook feed, which blows my mind. I would never want to get it that way, but it gives them the choice based on the content you create. Ethan, does that sound about right?
It does, and you mentioned something there that was key. You said consistent naming, and right, branding and what you name your blog and the domain name you use and leveraging your own personal name as a brand, and branding is a very big deal here. Think of your blog as a sort of a resume, and you're building a brand around your name and whatever other branding you decide to use. Therefore, keep it consistent across all the platforms that you leverage for social so that when your content goes out the door, people that are following you, however they've chosen to follow you, like Chris said, everybody wants to do it different. They know exactly what this article is that you've written and where it's coming from, and they immediately think of you, your brand that you've created because you've been wise about your naming scheme and been consistent across all the platforms so that they know what they're getting and from who. That's a really big deal. And then over time, that brand that you've created will begin to have an increasing amount of value because what you're doing is you're building an audience. You're building followers through that blog. People that are getting a benefit from what you've written will want to read more of what you've written. That's a good thing. That's something that you want. And again, going back to the idea of it being sort of a resume, that can be hugely advantageous when you are looking for that next job, that next career move. You can point back to your blog and your brand and say, look at what I've created for the community and the interaction I get with people and how I've been helpful by sharing all of these technical things that I've learned in my career. That's a big deal. And again, being consistent about your branding is a big part of making sure everything you write is stuck to that same identity, no matter where on the internet that content shows up.
There we go. So, I mean, and try not to be like LaserCats99 or something like that. It's not going to help you on your resume. Maybe, unless you're applying for a place that's all about LaserCats. So hopefully these are some tips and tricks and some ideas that you can use to either expand your blogging presence or start a new one. And if you do either of those, we'd love to know. Send a tweet to @datanauts_show or @ecbanks or @chriswall. Let us know what you're doing, what tips you found helpful, and what ones you would add to that list. But that's it today for this edition of the Datanauts podcast. If you're a social creature, you can follow me. I'm @chriswall on the Twitters, and my blog is wallnetwork.com. Or my delightful, happy, bearded friend, Ethan. He's @ecbanks on the Twitters. His blog is ethancbanks.com. For more of that delicious gumbo of Datanauts shows covering infrastructure engineering, do a nosedive down the rabbit hole that is packetpushers.net. You'll find us talking about containers and certifications, conferences, PowerShell, cloud, mechanical turking, I think was the term we used, full stack engineering. There's so much goodies there. Until then, my friends, may your server lights blink, your storage spindles spin, and your cables be cleanly managed.
Terrible. I'm trying to get three thoughts out of my head all at once. This is awful.
I suck balls on that one.